Hello, and welcome to another gripping episode of Monday Morning Institute class. Glad you're here. Today we're going to talk about one of those complex issues in the church that sometimes confuse people in and out of the church, and that is the role of Freemasonry played in the development of the temple ordinance of the endowment in the church. So let's start with something we actually talked about a couple of weeks ago. Oh, by the way, if you haven't figured out, I'm not in front of the class at the moment. We'll be returning to that next week. But anyway, so a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a literary pattern that we see often, something that Joseph Campbell noticed in the 60s and 70s and wrote about extensively, called the hero's journey. And if you recall, what that basically said was is that most great stories involve the journey of a young person who, in an obscure place, that finds out that they are actually much more than they thought that they were. They're woken up to the fact that they have this great destiny they didn't know. It's usually by supernatural aid. And so they begin this journey to move forward to find their destiny or find the thing that they're ultimately supposed to be able to do in life. And they have both a mentor that's going to walk them through the whole process and usually a team of helpers of various abilities. Now, this doesn't sound like Lord of the Rings or any of the other great stories in history. It is. And ultimately, we decided that it is also the plan of salvation where we move forward through this journey to our destiny. Okay. Now, we talked about this in conjunction a few weeks ago in talking about Joseph Smith's time in Liberty Jail as a what we call a wilderness experience, where he has to face himself. And he spent 5 months in Liberty Jail, and that when he emerged from that, he had been transformed. That Joseph, I think, on the other side of Liberty was a different man than the one that went in to Liberty. And he will then go on to speak for himself and have greater understanding about a number of things. The hero's journey. But one of those things that is true across so many civilizations, and I'm not an anthropologist by any means, but certainly true among so many civilizations, and that is this moment of transformation for the hero forms something that in every civilization they want to somehow copy or imitate this moment of transformation for the hero in their creation story, and they want to duplicate it so they can be like him or her. So a good example of this, let me give you three examples of it. Number one, if you've ever traveled at all to any of the Mayan archaeological sites, for instance, like Chichen Itza, one of the great sites to go visit, every Mayan temple complex has a temple, but right next to it is going to be the Mayan ball court. And the Mayan ball court is where traditionally teams of Mayans are going to battle back and forth with a big rubber ball to be able to score. And a lot of times, whoever wins sometimes is killed. It's amazing how that works. However, the idea of the Mayan ball court is based on a Mayan creation myth, going back to something that is called Popovu. And that is, it's the story of the woman that gives birth to the heroic twins. And the heroic twins in the underworld of Zabulba have a battle between them, and finally the winner emerges and creates people, the maize people. But that's something that the winner gets to do. So what happens on certain ceremonial days is that they're going to play out that creation drama on the ball court so that they can go through the transformation that their great ancestor did. That ball court you can find almost anywhere, and the story of Popovu is played out in a way that anybody noticing that or watching that sees the participants becoming like their ancestors. It's truly a great moment for them. Okay, now another example of this transformational tie back to somebody's history that results in a ceremonial replaying of it is one that is probably much more known, and that is that every year, especially for Catholics, they want to be able to walk in Old Jerusalem on the Via Dolorosa. The Via Dolorosa is really the way of the cross, the road of the cross on its way, Christ's path from being scourged on his way to the cross and then to Golgotha. This path is clearly marked out along the road, and for participants, when they're walking Via Dolorosa, they will find the signs of the cross, which are moments where they are praying different parts of the rosary, or they're somehow taking care of their and paying attention to different aspects of the moment. Excuse me. And in this way, those that participate in these steps along the road are emulating Christ and hoping to become more like Jesus Christ by doing the things that he did. But it's a ceremony, it's a ritual that is repeated, especially every Easter, as we get close to that. Now, another famous ritual that harkens back to a creation story in a civilization takes place in Peru every year. There is in June, there are three steps to a festival of the sun god, and the third part of that story is a massive festival that takes place with hundreds of participants and in Cusco, and where they're celebrating the coming of a sun god that brought them life and taught them how to live, all of these kind of things. And by participating in the festival of the sun god, then they're becoming more like that sun god. It takes place in a place called Sacsahuaman, just outside Cusco. So again, civilizations over and over and over, whether it's a bar mitzvah or whether it is a Native American powwow, always these rituals tie them back into history and hopefully transform them like it did their ancestor. Now, why is that important? Well, see, rituals themselves and the carrying out of rituals and traditions have four main pieces to them. Number one, they connect a society back to their origin story and remind them of their myths and kind of where they came from. It is reminding them that it completes a hero's transformation and makes them, enables them to change as their ancestors did. By doing that, it also unites an entire society with a shared tradition. In the LDS tradition, we know when somebody talks about we're going on a trek, or they mention the word hand carts, everybody knows what that means. They understand what the sacrifice was involved in the pioneer hand carts. And on top of that, then there's a shared understanding of a sacrifice that occurred in that particular event in LDS history. fact, you'd only have to show a picture of a handcart, and everybody in sacrament meeting would understand the exact same thing. Finally, one of the things that a ritual does is that there are important truths that need to be transferred, especially to kids, so that they can learn those foundational stories to their people. That's why, in some ways, a Passover Seder for the Jews harkens back to the question that is always asked: why is this night different from any other night? And that's important, because then they're going to say, "This is, we're now going to teach you how our people were liberated from Egypt and how God watched over them the same way that God will watch over us." So important truths are then transferred along the way. So rituals become really important to a society's education, to a society's bonding and brotherhood, and also to the cohesiveness of a particular group. So we shouldn't be surprised then that in the Middle Ages, there was a particular group of skilled artisans, the Masons, who developed a set of traditions and ceremonies that were focused on how do we create good people, make them better? How do we spot who the good people are in any group? And how do we then swear oaths of brotherhood to one another so that we can move forward in important projects? That gave birth to the order that we're very familiar with, and that is the Freemasonry. An interesting thing about Freemasonry is they have their creation myths, and it's hard for us to understand or even have information now on the efficacy of those ancient foundations and the origin stories for Freemasonry. Masons themselves will tell you, I'm not one, but Masons themselves will tell you that it began in the early Dark Ages, maybe around the 1300s, and that those particular signs and tokens and handshakes and ceremonies and things that are so familiar to Masonry were developed as a way to build all those things we just talked about. The creation myth that goes along with Masonry, that it's hard to, again, know how much of that is actually true, is that there was, that they were involved, the first Masons were involved in the building of Solomon's temple, and that they were, that they developed codes of conduct and connection among them there, and that those codes, those ceremonies, ultimately were maybe carried back by the Knights Templar about the 13th century, and they're bringing back these ancient secrets, the builders of Solomon's temple. Don't know if that's true or not. They're not sure that it's not more than myth, but they certainly make that idea back to Solomon's temple makes up much of what is done and what is worn and what is said in Masonic ceremonies. But at the end of the day, the result was for a group of Masons is that it would then connect them to other Masons that maybe they've just met in any society maybe they go into. They always have a home because the Masonic ceremonies and the bonding and binding process means that they have friends that will always have their back no matter where they go. Okay, so it works really, really well. Now, church participation in Masonry has a very interesting backstory, and one that I think is important for us to understand through all this. So let's go through the timeline for just a second. As the saints were kind of building themselves up in Nauvoo, in December of 1841, there were 18 Mormons who were also Masons that decided to organize a Nauvoo Lodge of the Freemasonry order. Now, as they came together, Joseph Smith had never really been interested in it, though his brother Hiram was, and his father was. But as they put that together, Joseph was intrigued, I think, not just by the organizational things that they were doing, but also the backstory, the tie-in to ancient antiquity, which for Joseph was always his lifelong goal of restoring. He felt like he'd been called to restore ancient keys, ancient understandings. We've kind of talked about that he saw himself more as an Old Testament prophet than new. So the backstory intrigued him. Now, that means that in December, these 18 organized, and the very next day, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon applied for membership in the lodge. Remember, to become a member of the Masonic Order, you have to be invited in. You have to be evaluated and to make sure that you're a good person and that you will be able to bind yourself in a brotherhood to the others that you're going to covenant with to be there for them. Again, Joseph and Sidney applied for membership the next day when they saw the efficacy in what was going on. The timeline becomes really important then, because just a couple of months later, on March 15th, 1842, they are visited by the Illinois Grand Master over all the Masons in the state of Illinois, Abraham Jonas, one of the few Jews living in that area, but also the Grand Master. And there's some thought that Jonas was preparing to run for office, and that he thought that this might be a good way to cement a constituency. So he's willing to go to Nauvoo. He formally installs the Nauvoo Lodge's officers. And on that day, he's going to initiate Joseph and Sidney as entered apprentices in the upper floor space of the red brick store. This will happen after they have had a meeting. They will go as a group from the red brick store over to the grove, where he will speak to a large group of citizens in Nauvoo. A lot will be made of this. There's some stories that says that Joseph might even have been hoisted up on the shoulders of the people as they marched over to the grove to speak, and then they're made apprentices. The next day, Jonas is gonna says that he passed Joseph and Sidney as fellows in the craft, and then also then the next step he raises them as master masons, and then he will leave. Now, the lodge grows. It grows into hundreds of members. Most of the active male members in Nauvoo are becoming Masons. It becomes the largest lodge in Illinois Masonry because they're all enthusiastically joining. The interesting timing, though, is that 2 days later, after this, Joseph is organizing the Female Relief Society. He does it in the exact same space, the upper room of the red brick store. And when he's speaking to them, he actually is using some Masonic terms when he urges the Relief Society women to, as they look at people to join, other women to join, he says, go into close examination of every candidate. He also warns them that they're growing up too fast. And he says, quote, the society should grow up by degrees, a direct quote from Masonry as well. Now, on the, if we jump ahead just 2 months later, on May 3rd, 1842, in the very same space, that upper room, he's going to make preparatory endowments to a few elders. And what's going to happen is that he's going to ask a longtime Mason, Lucius Scoville, to transform the room above the red brick store into a temporary temple. But he's having a Mason set it up. And then he's going to gather his brother Hiram and a few other trusted associates into that sacred space, where they're going to initiate the men, but they're also going to do it as couples. Now, the problem here is going to be that as he starts initiating members of the Relief Society into the endowment, that's going to be seen for all the world, for anybody else thinking about it, talking about it, for all the world, it's going to look like Joseph is bringing women into a male-only Masonic lodge, because so many of the handshakes, the clothing, the things that are being said are all being borrowed liberally from Masonry, but working towards an exaltation with God, not a moving towards greater brotherhood. But anybody on the outside will see that as Joseph is admitting women into Masonry. Now, that's going to have powerful negative reactions all over the place, particularly, we think, in the Warsaw Lodge of Thomas Sharp, who is going to be ultimately instrumental in helping bring the mob from across Missouri to Carthage just 2 years later. And so what's going to happen here is that that's going to begin to stir up all kinds of anger, and ultimately they'll go ahead and decommission the Nauvoo Masonry, but they will continue to do it. Brigham Young was open about the fact in Utah that he believed that the Masons were instrumental in organizing the mob at Carthage. So from that moment on, though, Joseph is going to borrow heavily from Masonry as he sets it up. When Brigham Young is setting up the endowment in the finished temple, he also will utilize this. He will organize Masonry symbols into the endowment, and that's going to be used. Now, the question is, how much was Joseph stealing from Masonry versus how much did he believe he saw truth and he was simply doing what he did, which was restoring things. One author has written that Joseph knew that preparing hearts and minds to receive all that God had in store couldn't be done easily, but he was not one to conclude that it couldn't be done at all. So, as angels had done with him and he had done with his followers before, he started with what he had and used what the saints found familiar, in this case, Masonry, to lead them to further light and knowledge. You can almost speculate, as he left his store for a short walk that evening after everything had happened, that Joseph thought of Masonic ideas and practices as a simple way to impart knowledge that was suited to the basest, simplest of saints, and rich enough to reward a lifetime's journey towards the broad expanse and deep import, Joseph's words, of God's own thought. So that's why it is, for instance, that we get to this understanding. An author, Samuel Brown, has concluded that Joseph translated Masonic ideas making the endowment ordinances an amplification and, in his mind, a reformation of Masonry. And so as he's doing this, Joseph is mining the Bible for meaning and restored, and he believes he's restoring missing plain and precious parts of the gospel that were being found in Masonry and some of their structure. So why not take that moment to reform Masonry at the same time, like he was doing everything else? Well, in this way of reading the evidence, Masonry, like the Bible or the Egyptian papyrus scroll for the Book of Abraham, was, in his mind, an artifact that required the attention of a seer, a text in need of a translation. He was going to restore it. He wasn't trying to fix Masonry, but he was coming up with a restored version that would work for the saints. Now, it's this understanding that that's how Joseph's followers, who knew both Masonry and the priesthood endowment, saw it. Some of them are on record, like Brigham Young, like Heber C. Kimball. Some of them are on record marveling at the way that Joseph breathed life into things that appeared old and broken, that he restored things that had been lost, and that he made plain things that had been confusing, and he was able to provide light to things that appeared dark. That was how they saw it. So they saw Joseph's utilization of Masonry as an expansion of everything else that he did, which was to restore that those things that have been lost or broken. So again, Heber C. Kimball valued what light Masonry held for him, but he also, in looking back at Masonry, he said that it had degenerated compared to what he was experiencing with Joseph's regenerating, reformatting version, and that is the endowment of power that he found in the endowment, and that the endowment was providing for exaltation at a time, again, when Masonry was just trying to build brotherhood and connection among people. Now, in one final note that should be put in here, we know that one of the things that happens in the Carthage jail when Joseph is shot and killed there, that as he sees his brother Hiram shot and killed, he's watching John Taylor be shot and scrambling to get underneath the bed, that he himself then goes fully to the window, that he stands to face those that are shooting at him, and that we know, according to both John Taylor and Willard Richards, that his final words all are, "O Lord, my God," before he tumbles out the window. It is true that there is a Masonry mercy cry that goes along the lines of, "O Lord, my God, they've killed the widow's son," or something to that effect. With those first few words, "O Lord, my God," is what he said, and it is a belief that he may have been he might have seen Masons in the crowd and was appealing for mercy, but again, hard to know for sure. The question is always going to be, how do we separate the symbol that we're looking at from the symbolized? How do we separate the symbols that we use in the temple from that is being symbolized? Sometimes we get so literal in our thinking, we're focusing on the symbol and we're missing the greater picture. A good example of this has been that recently an enhanced version of the temple endowment has been out there, where it clarifies in the process of the endowment that the veil of the temple is clearly the symbol of Christ, that we are coming, we're presenting ourselves at the veil, and we have a quick way using some Masonic symbols to demonstrate that we've taken on covenants and promises, and that we're willing to follow through on them, and that as we present that at the veil, at the face of Christ, we are then admitted past him back into the presence of the Father, which is the goal of the whole thing. If we do that, then we're going to also understand then that as we look around the temple and we see different symbols there, it should call to our mind what it is that we're being taught, what it is that we're supposed to learn from all of this. And that is the symbol that's included. So before we finish, can we just remind ourselves again that Joseph often liberally drew from symbols around him and drew from theology and understanding. He believed, 13th article of faith, that whenever we find anything beautiful or praiseworthy, we seek after those things from whatever source that might come from, because of the truth of the gospel doesn't preclude us finding truth in other people's beliefs and religions and things that they're showing us, and we can learn from everybody around us. It's what we need to do. If we pull ourselves back into a place of saying, well, we're the only true church, so we have nothing to learn from anybody else, we've set ourselves up for a much less rich life and cut ourselves off from sources of great knowledge and understanding, at the same time being really rude to everybody else. So that said, my testimony is that Joseph did draw heavily from Masonry, that he found there rich things and vehicles that he could use to help teach his people the light and knowledge and ultimately the endowment of power he wanted to give them, and that by so doing that he was able to then find a very ritualized form of education that worked very well, and many pieces of which we still use every time we go to the temple today. And I leave these things with you in Jesus' name. Amen.